We're going to begin with what Christian apologists call the presuppositional argument. I call it the desperate dilemma, mostly because presuppositional is a six-syllable word, scares people, they have no idea what it means. I call it the desperate dilemma. What is the presuppositional argument for God? Well, first off, what are presuppositions? A presupposition is an assumption or a first principle about the world. It's not something that you can necessarily prove. It's not something that you can even get evidence to demonstrate. Your presuppositions are the things in your worldview that you just believe what philosophers call a priori. Without actually investigating, we just know them because that's what we believe. The presuppositional argument, therefore, doesn't debate the evidence for God or against God. It debates our presuppositions. It asks the question, which worldviews, presuppositions, make the most sense of the world around us? Or which worldviews, presuppositions, best explain the phenomena that we all inherently know is true? As we look at this argument, we're going to look at four key areas, four key presuppositions about the world around us. The first of which is significance. Number one is significance. Here is an actual picture taken from Voyager, the satellite, as it left Earth. NASA put Voyager on a one-way ticket away from our solar system. I think last I heard it was outside of our solar system. I'm not sure. It's going at 10 million miles an hour or whatever. Very fast out of our solar system. Here's a picture. You see, there's Earth. There's the moon a little bit to the left. Last known photograph from Voyager was this. There's the planet Earth. Okay, a little speck on that screen. And really, what is the planet Earth in comparison to the enormity of the universe? What is it really? We're just a little blue and green little ball floating through the vacuum of space, surrounded by almost an infinite nothingness. Certainly, the planet Earth will end in heat death. This is assumed based on the second law of thermodynamics that says that all usable energy will be expended in a closed system. It doesn't mean that energy will lower. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed. That's the first law. Second law teaches that usable energy will eventually be expended. It will turn to entropy. So eventually all of the energy in the universe will burn out. All the lights will be shut off. All the heat will go out. Even black holes on this model will be slowly ripped apart until the universe, probably 100 billion years from now, will just be completely cold, silent, dead. There will be nothing left of our universe. It will end in heat death. One thing that's important to point out is that this is not probably going to happen. It's certainly going to happen. This will happen if you believe in modern science, that is, if the second law of thermodynamics is in fact true. It's not a probability, it's a certainty. Well, here's the question. How can our lives have significance if that is the certain ultimate fate of our universe? Well, maybe if our sun burns out, we could go to Alpha Centauri, the closest star. Yeah, but that one's going to burn out too. We'll never be able to star hop enough that we'd be able to escape this ultimate fate. So here's the question. Why is your life or my life ultimately significant given that certain fate? When I was in grade school, I used to write equations like this up on the blackboard. 21 plus 52 minus 108 plus 231 plus 675. And then I would say times zero. So the kids in grade school would be like 21 plus 52. Okay, 373 minus 108 and be negative 3 plus 231 times zero. Oh, you know, it all ended in zero after all, you know. Now, what if one of the kids said, wait a minute, what if we did 21,000 plus 52 minus 108 plus 231 plus 675 times zero? Well, 21,000 plus 52 would be 21,052 minus 1 away would be 20,000. Oh, multiplied by, well, wait a minute. What if it was 21 plus 52 minus 108 plus 231,000 plus 675 times 0? Well, I'm sure you get the point here. It all ends in 0. You might be a plus 21. Some of you look more like a minus 108, okay? But in the end, it all ends in 0. It doesn't matter either way. It doesn't matter if you were a positive influence or a negative. It all has the same ending, the same conclusion. You know, I was sitting around with my grandfather a couple years ago. He was getting really old. He still is really old, actually. We were in his basement, and he had one of these brand new Apple computers, which he doesn't know how to use. He's elderly. His little stubby fingers are trying to figure out how to use this computer. And he had scanned in all of these old black and white pictures up on this screen. And so he was going through the pictures with me. It was a really kind of a cool moment with me and my grandfather talking. And he says, hey, James, you know who that is? You know, black and white picture, really old. I don't know, Grandpa. Oh, that's your great-grand-aunt Beatrix, you know. Okay, do you know who that is? No, I have no idea. Well, that's your great-grand-uncle, you know, Seamus or whatever, Irish family. All these Irish names. So finally he says, do you know who that is? And he pointed at the screen. It was this little boy in the picture. And I said, no. And he said, that's me, dummy. That's me when I was 6 years old. So I said, man, you were a really ugly child. I didn't say that. I'm kidding. But he said, you know who that is? And it was the man standing next to him. He had his hand on his shoulder. I said, no. He's getting kind of sick of this at this point. He said, that's your great-grandfather. And right at that moment, it struck me. Not only could I not pick my great-grandfather out of a lineup, I couldn't tell you his first name. How many of you could actually, do you know all of your great-grandparents' first names? Wait a minute. Weren't they significant to your life? Well, yeah. If they weren't here, then you wouldn't be here either. Yeah, but you see the point. Even people that were significant to you, significant to your individual life, you don't even know who they are. Already, the tides of time are wiping their significance off the face of the earth. Maybe you're a really important person. Maybe you influence a lot of people. Maybe you're a politician or a doctor, a lawyer, actor, a writer. Maybe you're somebody really important. Well, then maybe your significance will last 100 years, maybe 200 years tops. Well, maybe you're really significant. Maybe you started a war. Then people will know about you for 500 years after you die. But in the end, the tides of time are going to wipe our species off this planet. No one will even know that you were here. It's likely that your great-grandchildren might not even know your first name. Here's the way Jean-Paul Sartre writes about it. This is in his massive book, Being and Nothingness. Sartre was an atheistic existentialist, very popular in the 50s. He explains this problem this way. He says, thus, it amounts to the same thing whether one gets drunk alone or is the leader of nations. In the end, the human race ends the same way. No such thing as ultimate significance. Now, someone might say, well, I impacted a lot of people. I helped the poor. I was kind to other people. I'm glad to hear that. You know, that shows that you had a nice relative impact on them. But there's no such thing as ultimate impact, ultimate significance in the absence of God and eternal life. Well, if you don't like the atheistic French existentialist, you might like Robert Plant, rock singer from Led Zeppelin's rock band. Probably I put Plant in my top five rock singers of all time, actually. Very gifted vocalist. Not such a gifted songwriter, but this song lyric was pretty powerful for me. This is from the song That's the Way. Plant writes, and yesterday I saw you kissing tiny flowers. But all that lives is born to die. And so I say to you that nothing really matters. And all you do is stand and cry. Pretty significant verse when you think about it. All that lives is born to die. If that's true, then nothing really matters. And if that's true, well, if we really came to grips with that, if we really understood what that meant, that nothing truly matters. Nothing is ultimately significant at all. Well, his character in the song just stands there and cries. If we came to grips with the despair of what it would look like to live in a universe without God, that's what we would be doing. We'd be crying, weeping over our species. For some sick reason, evolution made a species of persons, not a species of primates. We're aware that nothing we do matters, only to get sucked right back down into the universe. We were coughed up like a bunch of phlegm. It's just going to swallow us right back down. Now, someone might say, well, wait a minute, I don't believe in God, but I think the things that I do are ultimately significant. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I think so, too. I agree. You see, from my Christian worldview, I think the things that you do, they do have an ultimate significance, the way you impact people. There's just one problem with that. Your worldview doesn't support the idea of being ultimately significant. So while you're content in your atheistic worldview, you're not being consistent with it. Let me repeat that. While you're being content in your atheistic worldview, you're not being consistent with it. If one were to be consistent with an atheistic worldview, it would lead inevitably to despair. That's number one, significance. Let's move on to number two, equality. Equality. Is there such a thing as equality? Are all people created equal? That's the question. Well, you might already find yourself nodding, right? We're all created equal in this room. We're all equal. Let's think about this idea of equality for a moment. If you had a dollar and I had 10 dimes and you said you want to trade, a dollar for 10 dimes? Yeah, that makes sense. That's equal. That's an equal, fair trade. You give me a dollar, I give you 10 dimes. That's equal. What if you had a six-pack of beer and I had six beers and you wanted to trade? Well, presuming you don't have natural light, of course, I would make a trade on that any day of the week. Six-pack of beer and six beers, equal trade. Here's the question we need to ask, though. Are these two men equal? On the left, we have famed astrophysicist Stephen Hawking. He's dying of Lou Gehrig's disease. He's about 70 years old. And we have the greatest trader in the history of Cleveland on the right, Mr. LeBron James. Here's the question. Are these two men equal to one another? I'm going to argue, obviously, they are not. Obviously, they're not equal. Well, someone might say, well, wait a minute, they're both human. You're absolutely right. They are both human. They're both from the human species. They're both Homo sapiens, but they're not both equal. Well, somebody will come back and say, well, wait a minute, they have things in common. You're right, they do have things in common. They both have two arms, two legs, and one belly button. But that doesn't make them equal. They have the same body parts, but that doesn't make them equal. Are we really saying that we're going to base equality on body parts? What about people that have lost body parts? That would mean that a kidney donor who only has one kidney would not technically be equal with someone who has two kidneys. Likewise, men and women would not have equality because they have different body parts. If you need an explanation for that, I'll talk to you about it later. But we can't say that these two men are equal based on their body parts. That would be absurd. Obviously, LeBron James is stronger, faster, and more agile than Stephen Hawking. Then again, Stephen Hawking is far more intelligent than LeBron James. If you think these two men are equal, then I have a question for you. Do you think that LeBron James should be able to publish papers in peer-reviewed journals on the subject of astrophysics? Do you think that Stephen Hawking should start for the Miami Heat? Obviously not. Clearly, these men are not equal. Okay, if you think that having things in common make you equal, then consider a Porsche and a Toyota Corolla. Okay, both of these cars have four wheels, some windows, and a steering wheel, right? Are they equal cars? Of course not. If you think they're equal cars, then I would like to offer you a trade. I've got something similar to a Toyota Corolla, a Chevy Prism, basically the same car. Having things in common does not make it equal. If we were to actually have equality among human beings, this is what we'd need. We'd need two things. We'd need something that is objectively true and truly important. Is it objectively true that LeBron James and Stephen Hawking both have a belly button? Yes, that's objectively true. Is it truly important? Well, of course it isn't. Of course not. That can't be an actual basis for equality. What we would need is something that's objectively true and truly important. Now, if the Christian God exists, that would mean that we were all made in his image, as the Bible teaches. James 3:9 and Genesis 1:26 both teach that we were made in the image of God. We were made to reflect God's personal nature. Moreover, God loves each individual person on planet Earth so much that he gave his life and died for them. John 3:16 says that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. So God died for the entire world. But Paul in Galatians chapter 2, verse 20 says that the Son of God died and gave his life for me. If the Bible is true and the Christian God exists, then that would be both objectively true and truly important, that God places such a high value on human beings. However, if the Christian God does not exist, if atheism is true, then what would be the foundation upon which we could build equality? Here's the way atheist Ayn Rand writes about it. This is from her book, Philosophy Who Needs It. Apparently she does when you read this quote. Rand writes on page 120, egalitarianism, that is equality, is so evil and so silly a doctrine that it deserves no serious study or discussion. Of course, from Ayn Rand's point of view, she's an atheist, she recognizes that there really is no basis for equality, and anyone who tells you so is silly or evil. From her perspective, she was one of these really smug intellectual types. She felt like she was better than people around her. She advocated ethical egoism. But from her perspective, this is obviously false. She's not equal with other people. She's far more intelligent, has a higher IQ. So she thinks this is obviously wrong. Now, someone might say, wait a minute, I believe in equality. I believe that all people are made equal and that we shouldn't just, you know, steamroll over people that are being marginalized and persecuted, but all people have inalienable, inviolable rights and that we should all affirm as such. Okay, I agree with you. I'm glad you believe that. I'm glad you feel that way. I'm glad you have the same view I do on that, that you don't want to just steamroll over people and take away people's basic human rights. But here's the problem. While you're content in your atheistic worldview, because you affirm equality, you're not being consistent with it. What's your basis? What is the foundation upon which you can build objective equality for all human persons? If you don't have a foundation, then what you're doing is you're being content, but you're not being consistent with your own worldview. Wouldn't it be better just to switch over into a worldview that you could be consistent with? Number three, morality. Is there such a thing as objective morality in the absence of God? I'm going to argue, obviously, there is not. Think about this for a second. Think about morality from an atheistic worldview. We exist in a non-moral universe. You know, think of the atheistic explanation of where the universe came from. Well, it began with the Big Bang. That's what modern science teaches. 3.6 billion years ago, the Big Bang just exploded all mass, energy, light, everything into existence. Are explosions moral? No. I mean, blowing up a firecracker, blowing up a bomb, and as long as a little kid isn't sitting under it, that's not a moral notion either way. Explosions aren't moral or immoral. They're amoral. So the universe came from the Big Bang, and then it's eventually billions of years later, as it began to cool down, it formed stars and planets. Then eventually, the theory of evolution took into an account that we started with the amoeba, and that eventually turned into higher forms of life, and then that eventually turned into primates. And then finally, one species of primate walked upright, decided to say the claim, I think, therefore I am. They can use a remote control, they can fog a mirror, and can build social societies, human beings. Okay, here's the question. If we had a non-moral first cause, and a non-moral process, how could that ever bring us to a moral product? The same process that evolved the fungus on my feet evolved your family members. It doesn't differentiate between the life forms that it created. It's an amoral first cause, and an amoral process cannot produce a moral product. To put that another way, a non-moral beginning and a non-moral middle cannot produce a moral end. Another way to think about it is this. You ever watch the Nature Channel? I do. I actually like that channel quite a bit. It's one of the most violent channels on television, actually. And it's all real blood and guts, not the fake Hollywood stuff. It's real. You know, you'll see an example of a lion in the Serengeti. He's moving in on his prey. There's a gazelle out there just kind of moving around, and they'll show pictures of him, and the lion's moving closer, closer, closer. Boom! Jumps on top of the gazelle, sinks its teeth into its throat, blood splatters everywhere, rips its jugular out, the gazelle goes limp and lifeless. I get up off of the couch, I'm like, yeah, get him! Powerful, you're just totally into it. That's nature for you. Lions eat gazelles. Bigger animals destroy smaller ones. I love it. I can't get enough of it. Now imagine that a overprotective mother calls into the Nature Channel and she says, I want you to get rid of the blood and guts on your show. This is just completely disgusting that my children should be watching. That's real blood and guts on there. That's real murder going on your show. And I think that's just absolutely profane that you would have real murder going on your television show. Now, what do you think the executive would say to that overprotective mother? He'd probably say, lady, it's not murder. It's nature. That's what happens in nature. Lions eat gazelles. The strong eat the weak. The fast kill the slow. That's just nature. Well, here's the question. What's really the qualitative, what's the moral difference between a gazelle and a human being? Okay, a gazelle might weigh more than a human being. A gazelle might have more body hair than most human beings. A gazelle, I guess, can run faster than a human, but a human can use a calculator. What's the moral difference? What's the qualitative difference between the two? Well, someone will say, well, humans are far more complicated than gazelles. That's true. They are more complicated, but they're not more valuable. Or to put that another way, morality cannot be found in a test tube. You can't measure morality. You can't scientifically inquire about it. You can say, well, I can see that there are neurons going on here that produce pain in the human species. That's true. Now, can you tell me if it's right or wrong to produce pain in a human species? Not from science. You'd have to do that from your worldview. It's a presupposition. It can't be proven. To put it another way, morality in an atheistic universe is the difference between an is and an ought. If everything in the universe is the way that it is that true? Yeah, everything's cause and effect. Everything just happens the way that it is. Then how can you say that something ought to be the case? How can you say that something should or ought to be the case if everything in nature is the way it is? For example, if you looked at a test tube and water was boiling at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, you would never say it ought not be boiling at 212 degrees. It ought to be boiling at 213 degrees. No. That's just the way it is, the way that water boils at that temperature. What if you were in the Pacific Ocean and a little kid went underwater and came up and swallowed a big gulp of salt water and they spit it out and they said, oh man, the Pacific Ocean shouldn't have salt in it. Now, if that was your kid, you'd say, honey, I don't know what to tell you. The Pacific Ocean has salt. That's just the way it is. Or if a kid's working out on a summer day and he wants to go play basketball with his friends, it shouldn't be raining today. It's atmospheric pressure. It's just the way it is in nature. So here's the question. How can we ever go from an is to an ought, given naturalism? Or to put that another way, how can a naturalist who only believes in the natural ever look at one part of the world and call it unnatural. Is it natural when a lion kills a gazelle? Yeah, that's natural. Is it natural when a dolphin forcibly copulates with another dolphin? Yeah, it's natural. What about when a race of ants enslaves a race of aphids? No one's protesting ant slavery, okay? That's just the way it is. That's nature. We would never say that the lion murdered the gazelle. We would never say that the dolphin raped the dolphin. And we'd never say that the ants were enslaving the aphids. They're just taking them over. It's nature. But if you're a naturalist and everything is natural in nature, then how can you look at one part and say it shouldn't be that way? That's just the way that it is. Here's the way atheistic comedian George Carlin puts it. I've listened to every track of every George Carlin tape ever. This is one of his best albums, Back in Town. But this part is a little bit unsettling, to be honest. He's talking about why human beings are valuable. And from his atheistic worldview, he concludes that we're really not. This is the way he describes it. He says, how come when it's us, it's an abortion, and when it's a chicken, it's an omelet? Okay, of course you would never go and tell a woman who just had a miscarriage this joke, would you? It'd be pretty cruel to say something like that. From his worldview, he's honest and says, what is the qualitative difference? Here's the way Richard Carrier describes it in his book, Sense and Goodness Without God, A Defense of Metaphysical Naturalism. This is his atheistic Bible that he wrote. On page 329, Carrier writes that a human baby has more value than any animal on earth. I'm glad you think that. With the possible exception of adult apes or dolphins or perhaps elephants. Unlike George Carlin, Carrier isn't kidding. He's being serious. That there's these other types of apes and other primates, other species, that have more moral value given a naturalistic worldview. Richard Dawkins, in his book River Out of Eden, page 133, writes, in a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Now, from a naturalistic worldview, what's wrong with that statement? How, on the basis of naturalism, can you disagree with that statement? Ayn Rand writes in her article, A Defense of Ethical Egoism, a morality that dares to tell you to find happiness in the renunciation of your happiness is an insolent negation of morality. You ever heard somebody tell you you should love your neighbor as yourself? You should put other people first. You should care about other people rather than your own needs. She calls that an insolent negation of morality. Why should I care about them? She goes on to say, man is an end in himself. He exists for his own sake. And the achievement of his own happiness is his highest moral purpose. That's the point. What's the point of morality? To look out for number one first. Why would I care how it affects other people? Now, maybe I would care just so that they can pour back into me. Maybe I would pour into society or maybe a little club or a group of friends so that I could have better opportunities to get a job, so I could meet more people, so I wouldn't be as lonely. But in the end, why should I actually do something moral for another human being? Now, someone might be saying to themselves, wait a minute. I'm an atheist and I am moral. I love my wife and kids. I love my family. I love my friends. I am so glad to hear that. I'm glad that you don't treat other people like dirt. Treat other people as though they're not ends in themselves, that you don't stomp over people. I'm glad to hear that. I bet that's worked well in your life. Here's the problem. While you're content in your atheistic worldview, you're not consistent with it. If you were being consistent with your worldview, it wouldn't look like the way you're living. It would look far different. Our fourth area, our fourth presupposition that we should look at is the subject of free will. Free will. The subject of free will is incompatible with metaphysical naturalism, atheism. Think about it like this. We live in a cause and effect universe, right? Of course we do. The universe is governed by natural law, cause and effect. Planets don't choose to rotate around suns, do they? No, that's just gravity. Brings them around. Rain clouds don't choose to form over dry countrysides, do they? Of course not. That's just natural law. If I held up an object and released it, would that object have a choice to fall to the earth? Of course not. Unsupported objects fall to the earth. We live in a cause and effect universe. Therefore, nothing in the universe has a choice, right? Well, of course not. You know, tornadoes don't choose to bulldoze churches on a Sunday. Floods don't choose to wipe out a village. Think about it like this. Baking soda in vinegar. You ever done that experiment in grade school where you pour baking soda in with vinegar? Produces a chemical reaction. If you had the same amount of vinegar and the same amount of baking soda every time and you combined them every time, they would always produce the same amount of CO2. You could do that experiment 100 times in a row. It would still produce the same chemical reaction. So somebody would say, well, yeah, but our brains are a lot more complex than baking soda and vinegar. Well, yes, they are more complex than that, but are they any more free than that? Think about it like this. Nothing in the universe makes decisions, but human beings make decisions. Excuse me? Nothing in the universe makes a decision, but this one little species of primates on the third rock from the sun in the Milky Way galaxy, well, those are the only things in the entire universe that make free will decisions. Well, of course they don't. Of course we don't, given a naturalistic worldview. To put this another way, if everything in the universe is simply the result of cause and effect, then why aren't our minds simply the result of cause and effect? Everything around us can be explained by cause and effect, but why aren't we explained the same way? Well, we haven't discovered that yet. Yes, but when we do discover it, will it demonstrate that we're free, or will it only demonstrate that there is a cause and effect, a naturalistic explanation for the things that we do? Under this view, then, the thoughts that I'm thinking about you right now are not me thinking them. It's my brain thinking them. It's not that I'm in control of my brain the way that a violinist is in control of his violin. The violinist uses the violin to produce music. Under the Christian view, a person uses their brain to produce thoughts. Therefore, if we have brain damage, that would affect the way that we could think and act. If you drink too much alcohol, that would have an effect on the way you think and act as well. But your mind is using your brain under the Christian worldview. However, if there is no distinction between mind and body, if it's monistic, if they're one and the same, then how can we say that these thoughts that I'm having are actually mine? To put that another way, are we in control of our brains, or are our brains in control of us? Given naturalism, it has to be that our brains are in control of us. Well, somebody would say, our brains are a lot more complex. Yes, they are. A supercomputer is complex. Does that mean that a supercomputer is thinking? Of course not. Supercomputers don't think. They're a lot more complex than a regular computer, but they're not actually thinking. Put that another way. Imagine if I had 10 dominoes lined up on this table. I click the first domino, plank, 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 all the way down the line, and it knocks over the final domino. Well, what if I set up 50 dominoes? Clank, 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 all the way down until it hits the 50th one over. Wait a minute. What if I set up 50,000 dominoes and it had a massive cause and effect reaction? Would that series be any more free to do the things that it's doing just because it's more complex? Well, of course not. Well, someone else will say, well, our brains aren't complex. Our brains aren't the result of cause and effect. Haven't you heard of quantum physics? You know, at the molecular level, or at the subatomic level, that is, Heisenberg's theory of uncertainty states that there are certain particles that arise and go right back into the quantum vacuum. Of course, a quantum vacuum is a roaring sea of energy out of which these different subatomic particles pop in and out of existence. They come in and out of existence. We can't even see them. That's how quick they are. But it's theorized by Heisenberg that quantum physics is not causal, is not that it's cause and effect. It's just that particles are randomly popping in and out of existence. Therefore, our minds are not the result of cause and effect per se. Instead, due to quantum physics, they are the result of randomness. Here's a question, okay? Does it make you feel any better that your mind is the result of random firings rather than the result of cause and effect? Would you buy that explanation if somebody told you, well, yeah, I punched you in the face, but quantum physics, I couldn't help it. Random. I slept with your girlfriend or your wife, but you know, I don't know how I got into the apartment. Quantum physics, I just found myself there. It was random, and I don't know how I took my clothes off, and it's quantum physics, random, and there's no cause and effect reason. It was random. Would that make you feel any better? Of course not. That doesn't explain the problem of freedom whatsoever. Not even to mention the fact that some theorists don't even think quantum physics are random. They think that they're causally related. Moreover, our brains aren't relegated by quantum physics. They're relegated by neurons firing, energy. Very different. So that doesn't even explain it whatsoever. Susan Blackmore, an atheistic psychologist, in her 2010 book, Consciousness, A Brief Insight, she writes this: the addition of truly random processes to a determined world, as in radioactive decay or quantum physics, does not provide a loophole for free will, since these processes, if they are truly random, cannot be influenced at all. You see what she's saying? If our brains, if our thoughts, if our will is really the result of just random processes, if it's just random, not cause and effect, that doesn't help the problem. It actually makes the problem far worse. We could put it really simply in saying that free will implies action. Am I driving my brain or is my brain driving me? On the other hand, randomness and complexity involve reaction. But what we need is action in order to have free will in the absence of God. Stephen Hawking, an agnostic physicist, he writes on page 32, the molecular basis of biology shows that biological processes are governed by the laws of physics and chemistry and therefore are as determined as the orbits of the planets. You see what he's saying? Our processes are just the same as the planets revolving around the sun. So it seems that we are no more than biological machines and that free will is just an illusion. What a stunning admission from a naturalist like Stephen Hawking. Leonid Perlovsky, a visiting scholar from Harvard University, in his article Free Will and Advances in Cognitive Science, this is very recent, 2012, he writes that the reconciliation of scientific causality and free will remains an unsolved problem. He's not a believer in God. He just admits if we live in a cause and effect universe and there's such a thing as free will, those things cannot be correlated at all. J.L. Mackey, the late atheistic philosopher, in his book The Miracle of Theism, writes this: we ordinarily have an illusion of the literally immediate fulfillment of some of our own intentions. He writes, this is even a useful illusion. Francis Crick, one of the gentlemen who discovered DNA, atheist in his book, The Astonishing Hypothesis, writes this: the astonishing hypothesis is that you, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will, are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Dr. Crick, who am I? You are an assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Period. That's it. Then he goes on to write a 200-page book about how we don't have a free will. Pierre Jean-Georges Cavaignes, an atheistic philosopher from the Enlightenment, writes that the brain secretes thought as the liver secretes bile. It's like the heart pumps blood, the liver secretes bile, and the brain produces brain gas, which is just your thoughts. It's pumping out thoughts that way. Okay, so somebody might say, wait a minute. But I think I have a free will. I think that, you know, I judge other people as though the things they do, they are responsible for. I feel like I'm in control of my actions. Look, I'm going to move my arm to the right. There it is. You know, I feel like I'm in control of me. And it's not that my brain is in control of me. That's wonderful. I agree with you. Here's the problem. While you're content with your atheistic worldview and believing that you have control of yourself, you're not being consistent with it. Do you see the tension? Either you can be content with your worldview and you're inconsistent, or you can be consistent with your worldview and be discontent. But you can't be both unless you adopt a theistic worldview. The denial of God creates tension. Let's see if we can see how this actually plays out in people's lives. The denial of God creates tension. You can either be, to put this another way, you can either be content in your atheistic worldview, or you can be consistent with your atheistic worldview, but you can't be both at the same time. You're either or. That's the desperate dilemma. Either you get to be content or you get to be consistent. If you're consistent, you're discontent. If you're content, it's only because you're being inconsistent. So let's read some atheists on the desperate dilemma. Jay Budizhutsky, a former atheistic philosopher, in his article Escape from Nihilism, he actually became a believer in God later in life, but he got all the way through his PhD in ethics and then decided that his worldview was so inconsistent that he couldn't live it out and eventually became a Christian. This is what Dr. Jay Budizhutsky writes in his article. He says, "I loved my wife and children. Somehow I still did. But I was determined to regard this love as merely a subjective preference with no real and objective value. And that I was involved in this love for reasons that were out of my control, traceable back to causes antecedent to me. Think what that did to the very capacity to love them. After all, what is love? It is not a feeling. Love is a commitment of the will to the true good of another person. And how can your will be committed to the true good of another person if you deny the reality of good, deny the reality of persons, and deny that your commitments are in your control?" You could see the more you would dwell on this worldview, the more desperate, the more strained and tense it would become. Annie Dillard, in her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, it's kind of a harkens back to Henry David Thoreau's book, Walden. She kind of goes out into nature to try and find her humanity. She won a Pulitzer Prize for it. This is what she writes. She goes out into nature and she realizes, you know, I'm going to find my humanity out there. Instead, she finds that nature is really just death and decay and murder and destruction. It's bloody. It's nature red, tooth and claw. And this is what she writes on page 177. She says, "This direction of thought brings me abruptly to a fork in the road where I stand paralyzed, unwilling to go on, for both ways lead to madness. This is the dilemma." Watch what she says. "Either this world is a monster, or I myself am a freak. Either I can be content with my worldview, or I can be consistent with it, but I can't be both." She writes, "Consider the former. The world is a monster. Any three-year-old can see how unsatisfactory and clumsy is this whole business of reproducing and dying by the billions. But wait, you say, there is no right and wrong in nature. Right and wrong is a human concept." Precisely. We are moral creatures then in an amoral world. The universe that suckled us is a monster that does not care if we live or die, does not care if it itself grinds to a halt. It is fixed and blind, a robot programmed to kill. We are free in seeing. We can only try to outwit it at every turn to save our skins. This view requires that a monstrous world running on chance and death, careening blindly from nowhere to nowhere, somehow produced wonderful us. I came from the world, I crawled out of a sea of amino acids, and now I must whirl around and shake my fist at that sea and cry, shame. We little soft blobs of tissue crawling around on this one planet's skin are right, and the entire universe is wrong. Or consider the alternative. I must consider the second fork in the road, that creation itself is blamelessly, benevolently askew by its very free nature, and that it is only human feeling that is freakishly amiss. You see what she's saying? There's nothing wrong with the world. It's my thoughts that there is such a thing as morality, that there is such a thing as free will. We are freaks and the world is fine. And let us all go have lobotomies to restore us to a natural state. We can leave the library then, go back to the creek lobotomized, and live on its banks as untroubled as any muskrat or reed. You first. You see the dilemma that she's in. Either there's something wrong with this world, or there's something wrong with me. Either way. Skeptic David Hume, 18th century skeptic, father of modern skepticism, he writes this in his treatise on human nature. He says, I dine, I play a game of backgammon, I converse, and I'm merry with my friends. We've all heard this, haven't we? You know, I go out to eat. I guess we don't play backgammon. We play beer pong. I hang out. I talk. And I have a good time with my friends, right? That's what everyone hears Monday morning on campus when they go and talk to people and ask, so what did you do this weekend? And when after 3 or 4 hours amusement, I would return to these speculations, his atheism, they appear so cold and strained and ridiculous that I cannot find in my heart to enter into them any farther. So what's he saying? He's saying, I am content with my atheistic worldview. I have a good time. I hang out with my friends. We have a blast. But then when I come back and reflect on what I actually believe, what does he call it? He says it's cold, strained, and ridiculous when he actually dwells on his presuppositions about the world. Agnostic slash atheist Bertrand Russell, in a private letter, he wrote this. It is odd, isn't it? I care passionately for this world and many things and people in it. And yet, what is it all? There must be something more important, one feels, though I don't believe that there is. Why do I care about this world? It's moving towards nothing. I'm nothing. I feel like I should be involved. I feel like something matters here. And yet, I won't believe it. I won't believe it. You see the tension there. Michael Gazzaniga, an agnostic neuroscientist, this is from his 2011 book. It's called Who's in Charge? Free Will and the Science of the Brain. Doesn't believe in God. This is what he writes. Quote, the simple truth is that even the most strident determinists and fatalists at the personal psychological level do not actually believe they are pawns in the brain's chess game. Well, good point. I mean, how could you act as though you don't have free will? How could you think that? Blackmore, atheist psychologist, writes this. We can reject any persisting entity that corresponds to our feeling of being a self. So we can reject the idea of free will. The trouble is that it is very hard to accept in one's own personal life. No kidding. It means taking a radically different view of every experience. Yeah. You know, you're talking to someone. We're having a conversation. This is getting really good. This isn't me talking. It's my brain talking. In fact, I'm not really talking to them. I'm just talking to another organism that's pumping out words. And I'm responding to those and spitting them right back out. You know, every time that you felt guilty about something you did, don't feel bad. You didn't have a choice. You didn't have free will in the matter. Every time somebody cuts you off on the highway, no reason swearing and raising your middle finger because the person was determined to do it. Well, then again, I guess I'm determined to swear and raise my middle finger at the person. The same idea of being a self, well, you know, biologically, we're not the same components that we were when we were younger. When you were a little kid, you had different matter than you do now. So really, the idea that you have been you through your entire life, not true. You have different biological materials than when you did when you were younger. In fact, that wasn't you, those memories that you have. That was somebody else. She says it means accepting that there is no one who is having these experiences. That's what it means. It means accepting that every time I seem to exist, this is just a temporary fiction and not the same me who seemed to exist a moment before or last week or last year. Different biological makeup. This is tough, but I think it gets easier with practice. Is she kidding? Think about what she's saying. I can't live consistently with my worldview. I know I can't. I know I can't, but I'm going to try. I don't have a free will. I don't have a free will. Nobody else has a free will. They're just brains. They're just responding to stimulus. That's all it is. She writes, even if free will is technically an illusion, it is a very powerful illusion. And so the feeling of being free carries on, even for people who no longer believe it's true. In other words, even though you know you can't have a free will, given atheism, you still feel like you do. Such people sometimes say that they live as if free will existed and as if they and others had selves. Wouldn't you love to sit down with Susan Blackmore and just say, Susan, why is it that you have to live as if your worldview isn't true? How do you know you haven't picked the wrong one? How do you know you're just not operating from the wrong presuppositions about the world? That way, they can live honestly without believing in something they know cannot possibly be true. For others, the feeling finally disappears. Yeah, right. Atheistic solutions to the presuppositional argument. Atheistic solutions. We've looked at four different presuppositions: significance, equality, morality, and free will. What's a solution to this? How can we get ourselves out of this from an atheistic worldview? Well, one way is to project a meaning to life, even though we know that there isn't one. Here's what atheist Kai Nielsen writes in his book, Atheism and Philosophy. This is at the very end of the book. He's kind of summarizing his whole worldview, his perspective. Dr. Kai Nielsen writes this. He says that there is no purpose to life does not imply that there is no purpose in life. What is that, wordplay? What's he doing there? It's kind of tricky. Okay, there's no purpose to life, but maybe there's like purposes in life. Okay, let's see where he goes with this. There is nothing man was made for, but he can and does have purposes in the sense that he has aims, goals, and things he finds worth seeking and admiring. Okay, so we weren't made for anything, but we can go out and make our own meaning. We can project a meaning. There are indeed things we prize and admire. The achievement of these things and the realization of our aims and desires, including those we are most deeply committed to, can and typically do give significance and moral ambience to our lives. Okay, so you see his point. You know, we weren't created for any purpose. There is no meaning, but maybe we can create a meaning. You know, I want to be a doctor. I want to be a lawyer. I want to make money. Okay, I project that meaning out into the world, and then I go, there's aims and desires, and I go and fulfill that purpose that I create. You know, you Christians think that God gives you your purpose. Why don't you just give yourself your own purpose? That's his point. Well, what about projecting a meaning? I guess, first of all, I would bring up the concept of the placebo effect. You guys all know what a placebo effect is. That's where they don't have a medicine that can help you. But what they do is they bring in a sugar pill and they give you the sugar pill. They actually charge you pretty good for these sugar pills. So you really think it's medicine. And then what you do is they say you have to take one of these twice a day with water. And they give a very specific procedure for taking the sugar pill. And what they found is that people who take sugar pills and eat sugar pills thinking it's medicine end up in many cases feeling better from minor ailments. They think they're taking medicine, so they actually feel like they're getting better. Okay, here's the problem with the placebo effect, though. Placebo effects cannot work if you know you're taking a placebo. What if I came in and said, I'm going to charge you $10 for this pill? Really? Yeah, this is the medicine that's going to fix you. How does it work? Well, it's a sugar pill, and if you take it, it'll trick you into thinking you're feeling better, and then, you know, then you'll feel better. dude, you just blew the ruse there. I mean, you had me going there for a second. Now you told me. Now I can't believe it's going to work. Placebos can't work if we know that they're a sugar pill. To put that another way, the more that you know you're taking a placebo, the less it's able to work. So think about it like this, okay? I know that there is no purpose to life. There is no meaning. There is no morality. Okay, the more I know that that's true, the less my placebo effect, my worldview, my aims and goals, the less those are able to work for me. Secondly, we can point out what happens when meanings conflict. Say, for example, your meaning is to be a Mother Teresa. You know, you have a lot of aims and desires and goals, and your purpose is to go and help poor people in Calcutta. Okay, what if somebody else's impulse and desire and aim is to be a Ted Bundy and to go rape and kill sorority girls? You know, you say you have a purpose to life, and he says he has a purpose to life. Well, wait a minute, I have aims and desires and goals. Oh boy, he's really got a lot of aims and desires and goals from his perspective as well. Well, this is like, in my heart, I really feel like this is true. But he feels the exact same way. Actually, evolution has programmed your aims and desires in that direction, and his aims and desires in his direction. What happens when meanings conflict? Okay, think of another example. Maybe somebody here says, my purpose to life is saving the rainforests. Okay, sounds like a good purpose to life. And you, sir, what's your purpose to life? My purpose is cutting down the rainforest and making copious amounts of money. Okay, wait a minute. You have a purpose in saving the rainforest. You have a purpose in cutting it down. Which is true? Isn't it obvious? Neither are true. Neither are objectively true. We're just projecting these out onto the universe, which doesn't care if we have a purpose or not. I think the best way of explaining this is by way of illustration. It's a story about an artist. Okay, Steve the artist. Steve is a modern artist. He lives in Greenwich Village in New York City. He's been doing modern art, paint splatterings and color and fusion, all these great modern art techniques. And by the age of 45, Steve starts to realize, you know, I just don't really like this modern art gig anymore. In fact, I kind of hate it. It's getting kind of boring. And, you know, the people around me are kind of stale and stiff, and I don't really like this crowd anyways. I think I'm going to go back to college for business. So to go out with a bang rather than with a whimper, Steve decides to bring his niece and nephew, who are 4 and 5 years old, into his apartment. And he puts up a big canvas in his apartment, and he gives his niece and nephew these two big buckets of paint, and he just tells them, go at it, okay, get in there and throw that paint at that canvas all you want. So his niece and nephew are having a blast, like throwing globs of paint. It's just chance and necessity. It's vomiting up all over the canvas. You know, by the time they're done, they've been doing it for 2 or 3 hours. It's just this big mess. And Steve's like, perfect. Great job. He takes the kids home to their mom and dad. A week later, Steve tells all the art critics in the community, he says, I'm about to retire. And before I do, I would like to reveal my absolute masterpiece. And he says, I want you to come over to my house at 8 o'clock on Friday night. Bring all the art critics. Bring all the people. We're going to come down right there. And we're going to have a big soiree. Bring wine, bring cheese, bring it all. We're going to have a blast, okay? So all the art critics and all the art aficionados come to Steve's pad about 8 o'clock. And by 10 o'clock, they're really, you know, starting to have a good time. And they're really anticipating seeing Steve's painting. They can't wait to get their eyes on this thing. Finally, at about 10:30, Steve goes up to the painting and he says, ladies and gentlemen, I present to you my life's work, my greatest work. I call it The Meaning of Life. And he pulls the velvet robe away from the thing and he moves back into the background, and all these art critics, you know, move up and they start looking at it. And they're, you know, so one of them says to themselves, oh, I think it's about the plight of women in the workplace, you know, the color and the tension. And somebody else says, no, you idiot. You know, of course, it's not about women. It's about slavery back in the 1860s. Somebody says, no, that's completely ridiculous. Of course, this is talking about the relationship that he had with his mother and how he never loved his mother. And somebody else says, I think this is actually describing the last episode of Lost, which nobody can figure out. Everyone has an interpretation. Everyone's projecting their meaning onto this painting, okay? So finally, Steve can't handle it any longer. He's downed his second bottle of wine. He's in the background. He's just laughing to himself. He comes out in front of everyone and he just says, "You fools, how can you believe that this painting is a piece of art? It's a giant pile of crap. I had my nieces and nephews throw globs of paint at this thing. You think there's a meaning? There's no meaning. It's meaningless. It's just random globs of paint. It's chance and necessity, cause and effect. There's no meaning to this pile of junk. Nobody created it. It's just a pile of junk." So, of course, the art critics start to move away from the painting and they, throw down their cheese and wine and they stomp out of his room and they, "God, what a jerk that he would put us up like that." So Steve herds them all out of the apartment. He locks the door, kicks them out, and he comes back inside and he sees that there's still three art critics in front of the painting, still trying to discern meaning. So Steve comes up to them and says, "All right, guys, joke's over. Time to go home. I got to get some sleep." And the three art critics turn to Steve and they say, "No, we're still trying to find a meaning to this painting. Were you guys in the bathroom? Where were you? I told you all that this has no meaning. It's not the work of like a creator, that it has a purpose and like there's a meaning behind it. Somebody did. This is just a big giant pile of cause and effect and chance and necessity. There is no objective meaning." And yet the three critics say, "Well, we're going to project our own meaning onto this painting." Obviously, that's a load of nonsense. If the painting has no objective meaning, then what does it mean to say that it has a subjective one? Of course it doesn't. So in the same way, an atheistic person who's saying, "I've found a meaning to life, I've found a purpose," what they're doing is projecting a meaning onto something that has no meaning. What we're trying to say here is not just that the Christian worldview is internally consistent. That, I don't think, would be enough. A lunatic in an insane asylum could be saying, "Je suis Napoleon," okay? He is internally consistent with his worldview. He thinks that he's Napoleon, and he acts that way, true, or acts that way as well. Wonderful. Someone who is going to their death because they believe that their religion teaches them to kill other people, are they internally consistent? Yes, they are. They absolutely are. It's internal consistency. However, we're saying more than that. Not only is the Christian worldview internally consistent, we're also saying that it is, in fact, the best explanation. It's an argument from the best explanation. Think about it like this. Is it more plausible to believe that rationality came from an irrational universe? Do you find that plausible to believe, that we're rational beings, even though the universe itself is irrational? Is it more plausible to believe that purpose came from futility? The universe isn't purposeful. The universe has no purpose, no meaning. Is it more plausible to believe that meaning came from meaninglessness? Is it more plausible to believe that freedom came from determination or determinism? What's a better explanation, a theistic worldview or an atheistic worldview? Or that order came from chaos? Or that love came from indifference? The universe doesn't love us. The universe doesn't care. Yet we feel pangs of love for one another. I mean, how can you reach down and kiss a newborn baby on the forehead and say, "This is just chemicals surging in my brain"? How can you look at your wife after on your, your 30-year anniversary and say, "This is just me wanting to, proliferate my DNA and being in a herd species. That's all this is"? Is it more plausible to believe that morality came from an amoral universe? So I think as an argument from the best explanation, theism wins out. Moreover, we might point out that just because internal consistency doesn't prove a worldview true, internal consistency can prove a worldview false. Let me put that another way. So you can be internally consistent in your worldview and you can be a psychopath. You can be, think you're Napoleon Bonaparte. You can be someone who's going to your death for their religion. Okay, that doesn't make it true. However, if you have a worldview that's internally inconsistent, that'd be a truth test. That'd be a way to demonstrate that your worldview is, by definition, false. And atheism, theoretically, not only practically, fails that truth test. All right, I just want to pause for questions. I'm sure you've got a lot of them. And I left us plenty of time, too. Yeah, so the question is, well, maybe we do moral actions. We have moral notions and ethical urges because if I was just a murderer, if I was an axe murderer, if I got upset with my boss and I killed my boss, well, then, you know, of course, I'd get thrown in jail and I wouldn't prefer that. I wouldn't want to be there. And so living in a moral state is really just a way that's pragmatically, it works, it makes sense, and that sort of thing. Well, I guess I would respond that, okay, I guess that is true, but what you're really admitting is that there really is no difference. There really is no difference between Ted Bundy and Mother Teresa in the end. One was just more pragmatic than the other. It also does not account for the fact that some people are extraordinarily moral, other people are not. So in some cases, you have people who go above and beyond, not trying to just meet the bare minimum pragmatic foundation where they're just kind of getting by and avoiding harm and procuring joy, that sort of thing. But people who are exceptionally moral, like a Mother Teresa or Martin Luther King or somebody like that, you would, on that basis, have to call that person a fool. That they're not just skating by until their 80 years are up and they die. But instead, what you're saying is that person who's morally extraordinary is actually false and should not do that sort of thing. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, could you expand more on the idea of being consistent with your worldview? Well, I think there's two different types of consistency. There's the practical consistency, and then there's the theoretical consistency. I've argued that it's possible to be practically consistent in atheism, but you can't be content at the same time. I would make that wager with just about anybody. Anyone who says, I can live as though there's no such thing as free will, morality, equality, significance, I would be willing to let the buck stop there and say, you really can be consistent with that? Come on. However, theoretically, it's impossible for atheism to be the best explanation for these four different phenomena. So theoretically, projecting these out, the atheistic worldview doesn't stand up. So it's not only existentially that they can't live with it, it's that it's not the best explanation. Now, as far as a Christian not being consistent with their own worldview, that's obviously true. Of course, we see Christians acting as though there is no God, what Francis Schaeffer called practical materialism, practical atheism. But under our worldview, we're admitting that we are sinful and that we are fallen from God. So when we find ourselves straying from our own worldview, we have an explanation for that. However, atheism doesn't have an explanation for that. I guess their explanation would be that we are socialized into this and this is what we think is right. And so to abandon that would be abnormal and feel strange, that sort of thing. It's a good question. Yeah, over here. It's a good question. No, it's really good. Francis Schaeffer believed that you can use the presuppositional argument for all worldviews, not just atheism and theism. So, for example, he tells the story of a Hindu student, a pantheistic background, and he was talking about how there's no such thing as evil, no such thing as good, it's all one, we're all one and God, that sort of thing. And one of Schaeffer's guys was boiling some tea, so he brought a thing of boiling hot water and he held it over this dude's head. And the guy looked up at him, he screamed at him, "What the heck are you doing?" And Schaeffer said, "So you think that there's something wrong with him scalding you with hot water?" It says in this really poetic way, it says that the kid said, "No, there's nothing wrong." And the way Schaeffer describes it is, and he walked out into the darkness of the night. Kind of walked out into his worldview, just completely lost, but he couldn't affirm that that was right or wrong. So I think it can work in other worldviews, which we can get to that a little bit later. But specifically agnosticism, I guess you're in a really good position there, because what you're saying is agnosticism just means that there's not enough knowledge to know whether there's a God or not. You could say, you know, if you're looking between theism and atheism, which view do you think best represents these presuppositions? And hopefully they can concur that theism is a better foundation. One explanation for morality in the absence of God is that we get morality from evolution. Evolution kind of programmed this herd instinct into our genes and genetic makeup. So when we feel sad, when we feel bad for somebody being acting immorally, it's really just our genes and genetic code. For example, Peter Singer, an atheistic ethicist, writes this, quote, "Research on other primates shows that they have basic notions of fairness." So when you look at other animal species, atheists argue, look, They show kind of a herd instinct. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. Likewise, Franz De Waal writes, mammals may derive pleasure from helping others in the same way that humans feel good doing good. So why is it that we have these kind of moral notions or ethical urges? Well, these two guys say, you know, good for survival. It was the survival of the fittest. And if you could scratch each other's back, it was better for survival. However, far from being a solution to morality, what we find is this is actually demonstrates the problem of morality in the absence of God. Okay, it doesn't matter if animals are capable of helping each other morally. Let me repeat that. It doesn't matter if they're capable of doing that. It matters if they're culpable for doing that. So an atheist Darwinist might say, you know, we see that animals show moral actions. Yeah, they're capable of acting good. The question is, are they culpable for it? Are they responsible for it? This view actually confuses description with prescription. We're describing the way animals act. That doesn't prescribe why they should act one way or another. You know, when an animal, like a chimp, you go to see the zoo or whatever, when an animal throws feces in another animal, okay, I might laugh at that, but I wouldn't mimic that behavior, would you? I hope not. So, wait a minute. One of their behaviors I see them do, I'm capable of doing that. Another behavior that they do, helping each other out, I'm capable of that. Which behavior should I choose? Throwing feces or helping out my fellow primate? Don't you see that we're not getting morality from them, but we're actually projecting morality onto them? One behavior is good, worth mimicking. The other behavior is bad, worth avoiding. This is what Richard Dawkins writes in his book, The God Delusion. He says, an intelligent couple can read their Darwin and know that the ultimate reason for their sexual urges is procreation. Yet they find that their sexual desire is in no way diminished by the knowledge their wife is on the pill. So you're still going to feel that urge towards your wife, whether you know that your wife is, you're not going to be able to get pregnant. Dawkins writes, I am suggesting that the same is true of the urge to kindness, to altruism, to generosity, to empathy, to pity. It is just like sexual desire. You feel an urge to be generous, to be kind. It's because that urge was programmed into you. Both are misfirings, Darwinian mistakes. Here's the question then. If I have the urge to help a little child in need, and you have the urge to rape and torture that child, which urge is right and which urge is wrong? They're both programmed into us from Darwinian evolution. Ted Bundy had a number of urges, so did Mother Teresa. Okay, some people will say, well, what about getting morality from culture? It doesn't have to be actually objective. It could just be that we have morality because it's kind of normal, and in the culture, that's what becomes normal. Well, here's an example of the Atoro ethnic group in Papua New Guinea. The Atoro ethnic group I learned about in one of my humanities classes in my undergraduate degree at The Ohio State University. The Atoro ethnic group believes that it's perfectly moral for young boys to get the life force from older men in the culture. They do this by performing fellatio on the older men in the culture. I'm sure you can understand what the life force is that they're passing on. Now, here's the question. Is that culture in that area just as morally sophisticated as our culture on that subject? Of course not. And I'm assuming you feel the same way. I'm assuming you would never want your child to go on study abroad in the Atoro ethnic group. The men can keep their life force to themselves over there. If culture A says that love your neighbor, culture B says rape your neighbor, what if a member of culture A and culture B are both on vacation in culture C, which doesn't care either way? Who's right and who's wrong? Of course, we can always explain that, well, maybe we just feel that way about it, but I'm sure you agree that there's something wrong with that kind of behavior. Okay, what about morality from empathy? Other people will argue, well, it's not that we really have morality, but because I know how a bad action would make you feel, how it would hurt you, well, I can empathize with you. I can see how that would make you feel. And then I wouldn't want to make you feel harm because I know that's how it would make me feel. Atheist Peter Singer writes, if we want to know if something's right or wrong, we ought to put ourselves in the position of all those affected by our action. I put myself in your shoes. I wouldn't want to be punched in the face. And so I kind of project that backwards. Okay, there's a problem with this view of morality. It's a classic example of an is versus an ought. Let me unpack that. An is versus an ought. So, is it the case that I know how it would make you feel if I punched you in the face? Is that the case? Yes, that is the case. But that doesn't mean that it ought to be the case that I should not punch you. A serial killer knows, can empathize with how much torturing someone is going to hurt them. But he probably knows more about that than you do, actually. That is the case. Now, are you saying that it ought to be the case that he should not torture that individual? It's a case of an is versus an ought. Empathy helps us to learn what is the case, that person is in pain, but it doesn't command us what ought to be the case. I ought to help them. If empathy really means compassion, then what you're saying is you're arguing in a circle. Why should I be moral? Because I can empathize. But empathy is a moral virtue on that definition. Therefore, why should I be moral? Because it's the moral thing to do. Well, that's not a foundation. That's not an explanation. That's arguing in a circle. Another example would be morality from social contracts. Some people say, well, maybe there is no such thing as objective morality. Maybe we're just kind of creating contracts with one another. I agree not to hurt you. You agree not to hurt me. Maybe that's the basis for morality. What if I agreed, me and you got together, and we both agreed to rape each other's wives? You know, certain cultures, that was permitted. In Eskimo cultures in the last century, that was permitted. That was a sign of hospitality, to give your wife away to someone who was coming into your house. Imagine calling the cops on a wife beater, and you say, have you been beating your wife? And the wife beater says, yeah. And you get the cops out there, and you say, you've been beating your wife, haven't you? And he says, yeah, so what? I never signed a contract to not beat my wife. I never agreed to that social contract. Get lost. If you're saying that all people have a social contract binding on them, whether they agree to it or not, that's objective morality. That's not a social contract that you agree to. Finally, what about morality from maximal happiness? Some people argue that maybe we should just make things moral that make people the most happy, by and large. Atheist Richard Dawkins writes, the greatest happiness of the greatest number is the foundation of morals and legislation. If it makes people happy, that's what we'll make moral. Sam Harris writes, questions of right and wrong are really questions about the happiness and suffering of sentient creatures. He equates what makes you happy, what brings pleasure, with what is moral. Here's the problem. Are there such actions that would be considered immoral even if they brought maximal happiness? Consider, for example, if you were in a hospital and there's 7 people waiting on organ transplants in that hospital. One person's waiting on a heart, another person's waiting on a liver, another person's waiting on a kidney. And a really strong, buff young man comes into the waiting room, athletic, a lot of really good, healthy organs that he has. Under this view, it wouldn't only be morally permitted to grab that guy, stick him with a needle, and harvest his organs. That wouldn't only be permitted. It would be morally mandatory. You would have to chase him down, harvest his organs, and bring maximal happiness to the maximum number of people. You'd have to do that. Now, of course, that doesn't seem like a good idea. That seems like a scene out of a horror movie rather than a morally efficient system. Finally, some people argue, well, wait a minute, morality isn't always clear. Is that true? You know, is it always wrong to put somebody out of their misery if they're just only going to suffer for another 30 minutes? Should I give money to people who are starving in Somalia, or should I give money to people who are starving in Cambodia? What if you're driving down the road and your pregnant wife is sitting shotgun? And as you're driving, you see 2 babies are laying in the road. You either have the option of hurling the car off the road, killing you, your wife, and your unborn child, or you can run over these 2 babies and kill the babies. Which one should you do? If you find out, let me know. I don't have the first clue what to do in that situation. It's morally unclear. However, we're not beginning from the moral ambiguities, the moral gray issues, and working outward. Instead, we're moving from the moral polarities, the black and white issues, and moving inward. So if you want to know if there's such a thing as objective morality, ask yourself, is it wrong to hunt human beings for sport? Is it wrong to torture a baby for fun? Is it wrong to rape women for pleasure? If you answer that those things are wrong, then you can begin with the moral extremes and work inwards. We're not saying that as Christians we know the right action on every single moral issue. But like everything else, you begin with what you know into what you don't know. Before you study calculus, you need to study addition. We can start with those basic principles and move outward. What we're saying here is that theism is the best explanation for these different phenomena that we see in nature. If we think of the four different worldviews, this is really crude, it's really basic, but these are the four different worldviews. We have, on the one hand, polytheism and pantheism. Remember, poly means many, and theos means God, and ism means a worldview. So this would mean many gods worldview, belief in many gods. On the other end of the spectrum, we have what's called pantheism. This is the belief that God is in everything. Pan, think of Pangea, one continent. Pan, theos, ism, one God in everything. Here's the problem. Polytheism, and this might go along with what you're saying, Jim. Polytheism is personal. It's a personal explanation for these four different phenomena, but it's not an ultimate solution. For example, the Greek gods were polytheistic, and yet the Greek gods got drunk. The Greek gods were just exalted humans, big humans, sleeping with other humans and other gods. They were just like the Greeks, only bigger. But they weren't ultimate. They're personal, but not ultimate. Pantheism, on the other hand, was ultimate, but not personal. Okay, if God is everything, he's the final substance, that would mean that he's ultimate. But you would never pray to a pantheistic God. You would never speak or relate with him. He would never care what you're into. Eventually, it would be ultimate, but not personal. What we've been beating up on the most tonight is atheism. But atheism is neither personal nor ultimate. Finally, then, monotheism is both personal and ultimate. What Christians speak of is a personal, infinite God. Or a personal ultimate God. That's the best explanation. That's the foundation upon which we can have a basis for these different phenomena that we all experience. Think about it like this. In math, you see a line graph like this. What's that middle point called? Well, mathematicians call it the point of origin. The point of origin. To a Christian, the point of origin is God. A personal and ultimate explanation. Well, because a point of origin exists, we have an infinite spectrum there. Because that point of origin exists, we can do a second thing. We can plot a point on the graph, right? Well, what's the value of that point? It's a finite point. It's not an infinite point of reference, just a finite one. Well, because that infinite point of reference exists, that point of origin exists, we can measure this finite point. We would call it 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, over 3 and up 4 from the point of origin. Here's the problem, though. If atheism is true, then there's no such thing as a point of origin. And if there's no such thing as a point of origin, how can we still give things values? Those would disappear as well. Here's the question. Can we any longer say that that point is over 3 and up 4? Can we say that that point has a value? Over 3 and up 4 from what? How do we know it's not over 3 and down 10? Over 20 and up 2? Any answer would be just as equally true or equally false, which is another way of saying that thing has no value. In the same way, if you and I are just hurtling through space, surrounded by infinite nothingness, and we're trying to give explanations and values, says who? Who's the point of origin, or what is the point of origin? All right, well, that's all I had for tonight. Any questions before we close up? We got 15 minutes. Yeah. how would you respond to someone who says that, I understand what you're saying. How would you respond to someone who says that God gave objective morality, but it was really arbitrary? This is what in philosophy is called the Euthyphro dilemma. Euthyphro approached Socrates and he said, is something right because the gods will it, or do the gods will it because it is right? It's kind of a difficult question to answer. So here's the question. Did God will that murder is wrong because it is wrong? That's why he willed it. Or did God could just have arbitrarily commanded that murder was right? Well, if you say that murder is just wrong and that's why God willed it, then you don't need God. However, you say that God could have arbitrarily dictated that murder is right, and that's a horrendous moral system. You're saying God could have willed to murder your neighbor rather than to love them. The way to understand the Euthyphro dilemma, the way to respond to it, is not to say that God wills things because they're right, because they're good. Neither does he, this is really confusing, God wills things that are good, or they're good because God wills them, but that God himself is the good. God in his nature is good. God is loving. God is just. God is compassionate. So out of his nature come his commandments. For God to make an arbitrary commandment like to kill would go against his own nature. That's the way you split the dilemma there. Good question. Yeah. So really the question is, in what sense do you use this kind of argument? Sometimes it can actually push people away. When do you know when to back off? That sort of thing. Well, one thing I've noticed about this form of apologetics, presuppositional apologetics, is that they can often be very abusive. I've listened to debates on it where you can see it'll be a Christian and an atheist debating, and you can see the atheist not having a good response, but getting infuriated and just getting real angry, and it really bothers them quite a bit. And I think with this type of apologetics, you want to be extraordinarily gentle. And you have to have a very light touch, because if you come off too strong, it can be kind of abusive and push people away even farther. A lot of people just haven't thought about this. They don't know where they stand on these kind of basic areas. So I guess what I like to do is to bring up different aspects, different questions, and just wait to see maybe a faltering or somebody kind of thinking about things differently, and then immediately jump in and say, I know maybe you haven't thought about this, but this is kind of how I see it. And instead of being combative, being more like we're searching for these answers together. I'm kind of coming alongside you. And so I think you need to approach this with a really gentle touch, being very kind. Yeah. Don't go for the pin is the other way of putting it. Be kind. Yeah. All right. Well, why don't we wrap up here? 10 minutes to spare. I'm going so easy on you guys. I will not do this next week. I'm going to pack it with material. You're going to be in pain. You're going to be yelling for mercy by the time we're done. Why don't we close up in some prayer? How about I pray and then we'll get out of here. Lord Jesus, we want to thank you that following you, we can be consistent and content with a worldview. You said that you wanted to come and give us life and give it abundantly. And we're just grateful for that. Many of us here tonight have been able to experience that as well. The abundant life that you give and knowing you. And God, we pray for those of us here tonight who are maybe just kind of confused, thinking through their worldview, Lord. And we pray just even in their heart right now that they would turn to you in faith and just be like, God, if you're there, I pray that you'd reveal yourself to me and that I could come to know you personally. And we pray that these classes over the next couple weeks could help people kind of flesh out what they think and what they think about you. We pray that in your name. Amen.